There are few childhood memories as sweet and carefree as those spent playing video games. But while nostalgia often stops us feeling anything but joy for these memories, as we get older, gamers occasionally start to notice things about games we grew up with that either don't make sense or raise some very uneasy questions indeed. From truly awful Pokemon lore to Minecraft monstrosities, here are some creepy video game theories to ruin your childhood. Pokemon is a more realistic franchise than we give it credit for. And no, I don't just mean because my mom threw me out the house when I was 12 too. I mean, the setting. Each Pokemon game's region is broadly based on a different area of the real world. Sword and Shield were a look at the UK through a Pokelens, whereas Tropical Sun and Moon were based on Hawaii. Now the Black and White games are set in the Unova region, which is based on the American state of New York. In these games, players can catch the legendary Pokemon Victini, which fans theorize may symbolize something pretty dark. Victini's Pokedex entry refers to it as the Victory Pokemon, and states that its body contains a huge amount of power that could erupt at any moment. To reinforce this idea, Victini learns a lot of explosion-themed moves like Incinerate, Inferno, and Final Gambit. This has led many to theorize that Victini represents an atomic bomb. In the United States, Vijay Daymark's Day Japan surrendered to the USA after they dropped two atomic bombs on the country, effectively ending their conflict in the Second World War. The V in Vijay Day, of course, stands for Victory. Victini is also a psychic-slash-fire type, which if you had to assign elements to an atomic bomb, it seems pretty accurate. On top of that, in-game you catch Victini in a place called Liberty Garden, which, outside of catching it in a McDonald's, is just about the most American thing I can think of. But that's not all. Remember how I mentioned each Pokemon game was based on a different area of the world? Well, Ruby and Sapphire's Hoenn setting is based on Japan's Kyushu region, which is where Nagasaki is located. If you head to where Nagasaki might roughly be on the map, you find an enormous underground bunker built to protect people from a cataclysmic event, and what's outside that bunker? Barren wasteland, like the aftermath of an atomic explosion. Don't worry though, because Victini is safe and secure in the rational, mature hands of your 12-year-old protagonist. Oh geez, please think twice about throwing that Pokeball. Next up, Sonic the Hedgehog has been running, spin-dashing, and inspiring horrifically unsafe-for-work fan art since 1991. But what if I told you the blue blur may not be as free as he first appears? Let's consider Sonic's home for a minute. While the world of every platformer is a little contrived, Sonic's takes it to a whole new level, pun intended. There are loop-de-loops and corkscrews that would never form naturally, existing solely to be dashed through at breakneck speeds. Additionally, Sonic's world is full of things designed to help him. Springs, dash pads, moving platforms, and power-ups. And considering Sonic's world is depicted as natural and green, with the villainous Eggman acting as the only industrial force present, it makes sense that Eggman put them there. But why would he create tools to help his nemesis? Well, what is Sonic? He's a hedgehog, not technically a rodent, but a species that's lumped in with rodents like rats and guinea pigs. And you'll notice these animals are often kept as pets. That's right, this theory posits that the grand hero Sonic the Hedgehog is little more than a pet in a cage. While all the springs, loops, dash pads, and moving platforms don't make sense as natural occurrences, they do make sense as exercise machines, like elaborate hamster wheels for Sonic to run around on. Sure, there are enemies and traps in the levels to avoid, but Eggman also gave Sonic a way of gaining more lives, not really the actions of someone who wants Sonic out the picture, right? With that said, I dread to think how high Eggman's pet insurance premiums must be. During my time immersed in the rich, creative world of Minecraft, I've been unfortunate enough to interact with the nasty creepers from time to time. And no, I don't mean my weird Uncle Danny, who always invites me to join a game with him at 2 a.m. I mean the tall, green, frightening weirdos with an awful propensity to explode and destroy my hard work. Did you know, though, that many in the Minecraft community reckon these terrifying bombers actually have a rather quaint origin? That'd be the humble pig, and many speculate that these sweet and lovable creatures evolved into the monstrous creepers the community fears today. But it's not as far-fetched as it sounds. For starters, the game already has Pigmen in it, so we know at some point in time the humble pig arrived at a branching evolutionary path. And despite being dangerous, creepers also tend to live in herds, much like pigs. They're also frequently found in caves which contain mushrooms, and in the real world, pigs are regularly used to sniff out truffles. The other location they're often found, forests, hints at why they evolved to be tall and green, to eat fruit from trees and blend into their surroundings. There's even a meta level to this theory, as creepers initially came about when the game's creator Notch was messing around with a pig model and ended up elongating and changing the color. Loving the new freaky design, he decided to implement the abomination into the game. But why do they explode? Well, like many farm animals, pigs produce a lot of methane, if you know what I mean. So much so that some farms have even started harnessing that methane as a fuel source. So when a creeper runs towards you and explodes, you may not be going up in a ball of flames. So much as a ball of farts. Man, as if getting smoked by these things wasn't bad enough already? What do you think? Does this theory hold water, or am I full of hot air? Across all cultures, humanity has been haunted by the notion that there may be something dark, horrific, and unknowable beyond mortality. And according to Pokemon, it's cuddly pets. Ghost-type Pokemon have been a series staple since the first game was released in 1996. They're spooky, deadly apparitions that can't be hit by normal-type attacks, which has led many fans to ask, if ghost Pokemon are so ghostly, how is it possible to catch them at all? Why don't they just disappear or phase through the Pokeball? Well, what if I told you that ghost Pokemon, much like the villains in every 2010's blockbuster, all plan on getting caught? That's right, these innocent-looking creatures are actually devious puppet masters, and their ultimate goal is in fact to capture human souls. For example, the description of the balloon ghost Pokemon Drifloon states that it tries to lure children into grabbing onto it, only to then float away with them, never to be seen again. Next, consider the wonderfully named Palossand. How could this ghost ground type guy be evil? Well, his morbid Pokedex entry informs us that just under his friendly surface, there's a mass of bones left over from the people whose life he's drained. If you need even more damning evidence, take Lampent, whose Pokedex entry outright states it hangs around hospitals waiting for people to pass on so it can use their souls as fuel for its fire. Wow. These lovable ghost Pokemon aren't our pals, they're our predators. This is why they allow themselves to get caught, because a young, energetic Pokemon trainer is an irresistible meal to them. So they stick around, slowly draining their loving owner's soul, and considering they're already dead, they can afford to take their time and savor the buffet. Well, as we established in the last part of this series, people do eat Pokemon, so it only seems fair that they eat us too. In my opinion, there's no hero greater than Mario. He's rescued damsels in distress, toppled evil kings, traveled all over the world, and has even gone to space twice. Not bad for someone who still lists their occupation as plumber. Of course, with all that publicity, the Big M is bound to attract some fans, and that's what this next theory is built on. Wario is a brute who somehow has landed himself the starring role in two Nintendo franchises. He first appeared in the Game Boy Advance title Mario Land 2 way back in 1992, acting as that game's primary antagonist. Since then, he's popped up in countless spin-offs, assuming the role of Mario's enemy. However, when you look at things a little more closely, it doesn't really look like Wario hates Mario. It looks like he's obsessed with him. Let's examine the evidence. For a start, Wario is the exact same name as Mario, just with the M flipped around. When it comes to the clothes, Mario and Luigi are both plumbers and brothers, explaining their similar outfits. Wario, however, is neither a plumber nor a Mario brother, but dresses exactly like them. Well, they do say the greatest form of flattery is imitation. And remember, Mario is a celebrity in the Mushroom Kingdom. He even gets his own parade in the Odyssey game. It's a safe bet Wario knew Mario long before the two actually met. And speaking of, they show Wario's house in his first appearance, where you can see a giant creepy Mario statue in the back. Wario isn't an arch-nemesis, rival, or member of the gang. He's an obsessed fan who dresses up like Mario and stalks him. Considering one of the defining characteristics Wario's famous for is unstoppable greed, there's a chance his Mario emulation is more an attempt to cash in on the Big M's popularity than authentic obsession. I'm not sure if that makes him more or less of a villain. Five Nights at Freddy's is a survival horror game series that, while rated as suitable for those 12 and up, is incredibly popular with kids as young as 6. You play as a protagonist who's being hunted down by what are basically less creepy versions of the old animatronics from Chuck, E. Cheese. Horror-wise, the games forego blood and gore, opting for more innocent, albeit scary, shocks and jump scares. Spanning 8 main games, numerous spin-offs, and even several books, the series contains more twists and turns than a bowl of spaghetti. But with that said, there's something that's been bothering the community since its first entry. Who left a handprint on Freddy? If you look closely at Freddy's character model, you can clearly see the imprint of a palm on his face. This has led the community to speculate on who left it there and why. Some fans claim this is evidence that Freddy is behind the infamous bite of 1987, an important incident in the canon where an animatronic critically injured a child after biting them. Which animatronic, however, has been a topic of speculation for years. Someone trying to get away from Freddy may have hit his face hard enough to leave the mark, but the handprint looks too large to have been left by a child. However, another interesting theory suggests that the print was left by none other than Freddy himself. You see, animatronics are mixed and matched all the time, resulting in freaky creations like Mangle, an amalgamation of different animatronics. It's also understood that the animatronics are hollow on the inside, like empty suits with minds of their own. The size and positioning of the handprint makes most sense, not as someone trying to push Freddy away, but trying to get the head off. This theory follows that at some point an unfortunate victim was inside a suit featuring a Freddy head that terrifyingly turned against them. The panicked occupant then frantically tried to pry the head off, but soon met with a grim fate. So much for no gore. While we don't know who Freddy's victim was, considering the scale of this franchise, it's only a matter of time before they get their own spin-off book trilogy. Next up, if you've ever played a Legend of Zelda game, you've likely come across Tingle. First introduced in Majora's Mask, Tingle has popped up all across the series' convoluted timeline. The recurring character is recognizable by his skin-tight green leotard, short stature, and intense desire to become a fairy. However, this goal becomes altogether less wholesome when you learn he's 35 years old.
The countdown is on. Holiday shopping season is officially here. Uncommon Goods takes the stress out of gifting with thousands of unique high-quality finds you won't see anywhere else. But be quick, the best ones get scooped up fast. Uncommon Goods is all about unique gifts made by independent artists and small businesses. These aren't just gifts, they're statements. I found a personalized star map on their site that shows the night sky from any date. It's like gifting a piece of the universe. So cool. Uncommon Goods has something for everyone from history buffs to football fans. Plus, they donate $1 to a nonprofit of your choice with each order. They've donated over $3 million so far. So don't wait. Cross those names off your list before the rush. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/beamazed. That's uncommongoods.com/beamazed for 15% off. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary.
This next theory deals with the Wind Waker's Tingle specifically, but don't let the game's colorful art fool you. This Tingle is actually the worst. When protagonist Link first meets him, he's been imprisoned in Windfall Island's jail, which isn't a great start. After freeing him, he can be found on his very own island, which features a mysterious tower. At the top, you meet three men dressed like him, two of which are turning an enormous wheel. There, Tingle helps you map out the ocean and even aids in your quest to assemble the all-powerful Triforce. Despite his helpful nature, however, there's definitely something sinister going on. For starters, Tingle claims he was locked up just for looking weird, but considering there are very weird characters on Windfall, I'm not buying it. Secondly, the men turning the wheel are definitely there against their will, right? They seem hesitant whenever you talk to them, and without a boat, they have no way of escaping. But just what is it they're doing? Well, throughout the Wind Waker, you can find various islands that house great fairies. These powerful fairies can upgrade Link's capabilities, but are hard to get to. This is because great fairies are found beneath their islands. Link must use a bomb or strength bracelets to remove boulders to access them. Now Tingle's island looks like a fairy island. This has led some to speculate that Tingle's captors are turning a giant drill that's boring into a fairy's domain. It makes sense after all. Tingle's ultimate goal is to become a fairy. Additionally, Tingle spends most of his time mapping the ocean. Could it be he's looking for more fairy islands? Either way, I don't want to think about what Tingle will do with that great fairy once he gets to it. Enslave it? Eat it? Who knows? Oh, and for some reason, Nintendo also gave this creep his own game. Please, Nintendo, stop rewarding your creepiest characters. Next up, Peach and Mario really are the Ross and Rachel of the video game world. One game, they appear to be an item, and the next, they're just friends. But if this next theory is true, their relationship is way more complicated than we ever thought. In the much-loved Super Mario Galaxy, Mario embarks on a planet-hopping adventure across the universe. During his journey, he's aided by the mysterious Rosalina. She runs a space station where she raises Lumas, cute little star babies who eventually grow up to become planets and meteors. This kind of places her somewhere between a nanny and God, I guess. Over the course of the game, Mario can learn about Rosalina's history through a sweet and colorful storybook. The story informs us that when Rosalina was a little girl, she got whisked off to space, eventually building the space station with the Lumas. The story takes a sad turn, however, when Rosalina cries and tells the Lumas her mom is asleep under the big tree back home. Tragic as that is, it's pretty hard to deny Rosalina's mom looks just like Peach. They're both blonde, their facial features match, they have the same little hair flicks, and both can even float. Of course, this would all mean that Peach is dead, but how can that be if they're both alive and well in the same game? Well, hold on to your butts, because at the end of Mario Galaxy, spoiler alert, the universe ends when a super black hole destroys everything. Ooh. Rosalina appears and tells Mario that the universe is about to reboot. Some things will remain the same while others will be different. If this isn't the first time this has happened, then it makes sense Rosalina might be from a version of the universe where Peach has passed away. Friendly reminder that this is a Mario game. How are Bowser and Mario not constantly talking about the time the universe ended and rebooted? Is tennis seriously more interesting? Now, though Pac-Man is well past its heyday, the popularity of the game can't be understated. It was America's highest-grossing arcade game back in 1981, and by 1982, it had some 30 million active players. Thing is, though, despite its popularity, no one has ever really been sure what Pac-Man is. You play as a little yellow thing, eating smaller yellow things in an endless maze-type place, occasionally also eating cherries, strawberries, bells, keys, and starships, all while being pursued by ghosts. Over the decades, fans have tried to piece together exactly what's going on in the game, and no explanation is pretty. For starters, the entire goal of the game is to eat as many pellets as possible, which could represent pills, potentially anti-anxiety or antidepressants, which Pac-Man is addicted to. Cherries are also symbols commonly employed in slot machines, which, if you're running with the substance addiction theme, makes a lot of sense. The strange environment Pac-Man navigates represents his own psyche, confusing and maze-like due to his addictions. Finally, the metaphorical implications of being pursued by ghosts are pretty hard to ignore. These ghosts could represent any number of things, such as unrealized dreams, past relationships, or guilt. And it's only when Pac-Man eats enough pills he becomes invincible and is able to silence them, albeit briefly. That's dark. A number of other theories use this one as a basic framework. One piece of art from Travis Pitts interprets Pac-Man as a 1976 cosmonaut named Nikolai Pechmann, who witnessed his four comrades perish during a mission. Suffering from survivor's guilt, he finds a box of emergency sedatives and is soon haunted and hunted by hallucinations of his fallen comrades. Of course, more literal readings of the game are no less disturbing. One theory posits that the maze Pac-Man is navigating is actually some kind of nest, and that the pellets he's devouring are eggs. Rather than cruel spirits, this paints the ghosts as horrified creatures desperately trying to save their unborn babies. So, wait, that makes Pac-Man the villain? Either way, I think the lesson here is if you see a cute, round, single-color creature heading your way, just grab your baby and run. In Splatoon, players take control of Inklings, human-squid hybrid delinquents who splatter the streets with their high-velocity ink guns. The winning team is the one that's coated the greatest area of the map in their color. The game was a unique spin on the genre, which many viewed as a less violent alternative to other first-person shooters like Call of Duty, but they were dead wrong. In the first Splatoon, you discover the fossilized remains of a human skeleton reaching out for a disc and some familiar-looking consoles. This seemingly confirms that the fun, colorful world of Splatoon actually takes place on Earth long after an apocalyptic event has wiped out all the humans. But what exactly happened to us? Well, the answer may be found in the game's environment. You see, in Splatoon, the characters are limited to small islands with high elevation. Additionally, a peculiar aspect of the Inklings is that they die when they come into contact with seawater. Pretty odd considering they're part squid, right? Both of these anomalies point towards one conclusion: climate change. As greenhouse gases prevented heat from escaping the Earth's atmosphere, the ice caps began to melt and sea levels started to rise. This explains the islands and vast oceans, but also the water death. This is because as sea levels rise in real life, they also become warmer and more acidic, and thus less hospitable to ocean life. This means the Inklings were forced to evolve to escape their former home, something that's even depicted in this piece of in-game artwork with a truly Animorphs level mid-stage in the center there. So, next time you're having a blast painting the town red, remember that just under the water, there's a mountain of human bones. Good thing complete environmental devastation rendering the planet inhospitable for human life is just a plot point in a video game, right? Sincere apologies to the Pokemon community, this episode's been pretty rough on you so far. What with all the nuclear explosions and evil ghosts ruining everything? Well, tune out now if you don't want it to get way worse. Because I'm about to ask the big question, why do some Pokemon wear clothes? I mean, they're wild creatures, right? Yet certain Pokemon like Jinx, Machoke, Hitmonchan, and many others just turn up in the wild fully clothed. And once you notice that, it becomes disturbingly hard not to imagine what they'd look like without them. Well, as unsettling as this question may be, the potential answer is even worse. In the original Japanese translation for Pokemon Diamond and Pearl, the player can find a history book called Sinnoh Folk Stories 3. It informs the player, that reader, that there was a period in history when people used to marry Pokemon. No, I'm not making this up. According to the book, this was normal, as people didn't really see the difference between humans and Pokemon. Yeah, apparently there's no difference between a dude and a sentient, two-headed floating ice cream that's forced to be a battle slave. It's a match made in heaven. The English translation of the game wisely changed this line to indicate that humans and Pokemon used to eat together at the same table. So how does this relate to clothing? Well, you'll notice most of the Pokemon that wear clothes tend to be more on the human side. Bipedal, two arms, you get the drill. Well, what if these Pokemon look and act more like people because, well, they're part people? If those Pokemon human marriages resulted in children, it makes sense the Poke Kids would be somewhere between a person and the more cartoony, wild Pokemon. A lot of these more human-looking Pokemon tend to have baby and child-themed first evolutionary stages too. Smoochum is the baby stage of Jinx, Elekid of Electabuzz, Magby of Magma, and Tyrogue of the Hitmon family. Look, I gave you fair warning about this theory. Don't be mad at me if you never look at a Cloyster the same way again. How are your fun childhood gaming memories doing after all those creepy theories? See ya!